April 20th, the year 3030. My body feels like a thing that is not my own. It's like a weight, a hollow vessel that moves somewhere beneath my tired head. I let my fingers graze along the wet leaves of the bushes that lead out behind the cafeteria, their rubbery branches snapping back as they swish through my hands. This time of day is set aside for my post-breakfast walks, my time to think, my pondering trails, as Clancy likes to call them. But usually, I'm not actually out here to clear my head. Usually, my mind is on the small square of fish I've saved from breakfast, neatly wrapped in cloth and slowly leaking in my pocket. But today, I really do need this time to figure out what to do. Liam was at breakfast, laughing and joking with his alphas as if they hadn't just lost the title to us the night before. Meanwhile, our table was strangely quiet, even though we had one. Poppin was worried about Croy, as they grew up in neighboring outposts, and they are close. He had just gotten news that Croy was still recovering from the spider bite in the medical building. Poppin's sadness transferred to Layla, and Aileen was quiet simply because she had run through the woods for close to 2 hours, after screaming at the top of her lungs with more and more of the guards running after her. "I felt like I was prey," she said, and I tried to sense any accusation in this aimed at me, as her sacrifice did not translate into my winning the mission, but I found none. Then, of course, there was Clancy, who had a strange look about him, like he really had died last night and had then come back to life this morning. He looked haunted. Gone were the jokes he usually made, the easiness in his manner. Halfway through breakfast, I wanted to grab him and shake him, shake last night out of his soul and tell him it was all okay, that I saved him, that he was safe now. But what if I hadn't passed them close enough to see last night? What if I hadn't seen Liam trying to cut that rope? Where would Clancy be now? I see his crushed bones at the bottom of that tree, and I let out a strangled sob. Trellin was laughing loudly, and I could hear Liam telling her the story of his father, who supposedly is some sort of important bureaucrat in the Constitute administration no one has ever actually seen, and how he accidentally called some diplomat the wrong name for an entire evening. His voice was aimed across the room and at me, but I didn't take the bait, and turned back towards my squares of breakfast fish, not knowing if I could choke down even one. Each one of our group drifted off slowly until it was only Clancy and I, and then I told him I was going on my morning walk, and even though it is the only time of day that I get to be alone, I wanted to ask him to come. But when he looked at me, I knew he'd say no, and so I didn't even do him the kindness of asking. I wish I had, as I walked beyond the small field lined with bushes and into the dense forest on the outskirts of the Constitute campus, stifling another sob. It's not that far of a walk, maybe 2 minutes past the large boulder that demarks the Forbidden Zone, but the little black creature is already waiting for me, and she starts to lick her lips when I come into view. "Here, little Prue." I bend over and let the square of fish fall to the ground. Undeterred by the dirt from the forest that sticks to its sides, the small black animal gets to work devouring the fish. I'm pretty sure she is actually feeding herself quite well, as her midriff has bulked outward over the course of the year that we've been here. But she likes her fish, and I keep bringing it. It's unclear if she would come to see me otherwise, and I like her company on these mornings. She finishes and hugs me with her tail, and I crouch down and let her nudge my knees. "Did you know that you're a cat?" I tell her, and she dutifully ignores me, making the strange sound in her neck, I now know to call purring. Oh, Prue, what am I going to do? I am in shock over what happened, and thoughts on how to make it better feel blurry. I know I should tell someone about what Liam tried to do, as it appears that no one else but me really knows what happened. He meant to remove Clancy from the game, and he violated rules we don't even have written in the rulebook because they are so basic that they don't need to be put down. Attempting to kill members of your own class has to be reason enough for him to be expelled. I have to tell someone, I realize, and stroke Prue's glossy fur, soft and damp. Prue gives me one final nudge, and then, as if to tell me it's time to face the music, jumps onto a branch nearby, lifts her tail in final goodbye, and jolts off into the density of trees, disappearing from sight. I trudge back towards my dorm, where I shower and put on fresh clothes before a class starts. If only this were any other day following any other night, today would be exciting. We are finally covering how the collapse led to the Treaty of Epizo, and the reason the Constitute was founded to act as its gatekeepers in the United Cities of America. It's the history about us. But I feel so out of it, so lost within myself, that I can't get myself to care. As I take my seat behind Stella, I stare at the blank page before me in my notebook, and after placing the pen amidst its lines, it appears too heavy to pick back up to write down anything that Professor Melton is saying. So I just sit there and let his words wash over me and hope that it sticks, or that I can get the notes from someone before the test.
Today is the day, young minds to be molded.
Melton is clearly excited, and I inhale deeply as if I can catch his excitement through the air.
Today we cover how the ecological collapse ultimately led to the Treaty of Epizo, and from that, the birth of the Constitute and everything that goes with it. The Gospel of Gara, the Outpost System, and Childbirth Sustainability System, and, ultimately, of course, of how you all were selected to come here and serve in upholding the Epizo Treaty and the rules the United Cities of America must adhere to in order to not violate the laws we've been subjected to under the treaty.
Are we going to cover why the United Cities of America is basically exiled from the rest of the world?
I can't help myself, and I shudder when I hear Liam's voice. Melton sounds only slightly annoyed when he answers Liam's question.
Yes, we are going to cover why we are not allowed certain aspects and items that other countries are allowed, and how this has caused our cities and society to look quite different from, say, the Southern Pacific's or Europa's countries. Now, as I was saying.
Melton goes on to explain how 1,000 years ago, our country was in the midst of a civil war. That this civil war began decades earlier, but ended with the ultimate destruction of the Big Ten cities. After this, the United Pacific Army took over the country, but their colonization ultimately failed. Some say it was a breakdown in their technology, and others believe that there was an uprising. There is evidence of both, but none of it is conclusive. The country tried to rebuild, but this was when the ecological collapse rocked the world to its core. Here, so much of it sounds familiar. The failing of crops, the starvation, the story of famine and disease. And I realize Melton is telling the Gospels.
But now to the good part.
Melton smiles and starts writing feverishly on the whiteboard in large block letters, The Treaty of Epizo, 2830.
200 years ago, countries were recovering. Not very well, mind you, but they were. Cities were recouping, temperatures were returning to normal, the storms caused by the collapse were beginning to cease. But this time, the people of Earth realized
We can't repeat what we just went through. It was too much. Too terrible. We can't let this happen again. So, in what is considered the greatest achievement of modern history, every single country reinstated their governments in some form or another and entered into the Treaty of Epizo. This treaty outlines that we have to draw energy only from sources that won't produce carbon molecules, and that certain restrictions must be followed, such as population control, and if the treaty is violated in any way, all other countries vow to enter into absolute war to decimate any country who dares violate the treaty. Silence. Did he just say decimate? And this is where you come in. Every country set up a policing system. The Pacifics, for instance, have the People's Militia in the north and the Armed People's Police in the south. Europa has what they call the Peacekeepers, while Britain has the Pollies. Every country instated regulators to make sure their citizens abided by the rules of the treaty, including us, which is you all. Melton looks around the room, trying to make sure that the gravity of our job, that we are the ones to make sure that the UCOA is not decimated by all other countries on Earth. When he seems satisfied that it has, he moves on. And yes, Liam, other countries do not have the same rules that we have. But you have to understand that in this country, most of the carbon molecules were produced. We bore the brunt of the Epizo sanctions because we caused most of the collapse. There is no retort from Liam, for once, and Melton continues. The United Cities of America has a lot of rules, and while the outside world is aware of our existence, the people living here believe they are the only ones left. It's so we can remain isolated, manageable. We have elected borders, what you all grew up knowing as the Forbidden Zone, to make sure that people wouldn't stray. While this may not seem fair to you, other countries are afraid that we will repeat what happened last time, and let's face it, here Melton looks quite grim as he says, we didn't really have much of a choice at the time the treaty went into effect. He pauses for a moment, as if to gain momentum for the final speech, and then places his palms onto the desk, as if he's trying to push it into the ground with the gravity this speech requires. It might not always seem fair that the people you love, the people from your homes, are not aware of what is happening in the world. But it is your job to keep them safe. It is your job to enact what they believe to be the laws of Gara. Because, and here the professor pauses, either for dramatic effect, or because he needs to gather the strength to say it out loud. Because if you don't, they will violate the Epizo Treaty, and either we will repeat the collapse, or, far more likely than that, we will simply be wiped off this planet before we get the chance. Professor Melton straightens himself, and then slides his hands off the table and into his pockets, nodding at us, dismissing us for the day. I'm slow in gathering myself, trying to lag behind, trying to avoid conversation even with the people I still like. When everyone else has gone, I pick up my bag and start to head out the door. Rose? Melton asks as I pass, sitting in his chair, thumbing through his papers, not looking up. Yes, Professor? I hope he didn't notice my not taking any notes. In the end, I was paying attention, but I was still too frozen to pick up my pen and write. You look tired, he says, stating the obvious, still not looking up at me. I don't know how to reply. I heard you through the mission last night. That's not like you. I know. I just had to. I stutter the words, not knowing if I should just confess the entire story here and now. But I didn't do anything wrong. Would it even be a confession?
There has been talk, Melton says, looking at the desk.
Don't worry, Rose, we will look into it. Something like this doesn't go unnoticed. We need you to just stay focused on your work.
My body sags with relief as I realize that of course the Constitute would look into something like this. That the burden of Liam is not only on me. I was going to Ruston now, I was...
Don't. You don't have to. Stay focused.
Still, the professor does not look up, and keeps on shuffling his papers across the desk as if he's looking for something very important.
And you didn't hear this from me, but something is coming. And you look very tired, Rose. I suggest you go straight home and to bed. Tomorrow's going to be a big day.
Then he picks out a small note from in between two books, scribbled with what looks to me like random numbers or temperatures.
I knew I'd find you.
He tells the note in calm victory, and then he turns to me and raises an eyebrow.
Go get some sleep, Rose. You'll need it.
Despite having barely touched breakfast, I am not hungry, and I heed Professor Melton's advice and head straight to my room. At this point, my body is a collection of tiny aches, and my throat hurts from screaming. This time, I take care to disrobe, to rub lotion onto my face and arms that I've mixed with the wild lavender from outside. Then I slip into my bed, and almost instantly, I drift off into the nothingness of sleep, my room orange and the sun's late glow. April 21st, the year 3030. When I wake, my body is still aching, but I feel better. I've made a plan. I will go get breakfast with the team, and then I will go find Melton and ask him what exactly he meant when he said they would look into it. And if I have to, I will tell them exactly what happened. It's strange that my feelings aren't more muddled, more conflicted about turning Liam in. But this morning I find that only my horror at what he tried to do to Clancy is left behind, and any tender-hearted feelings I ever had for the man have been sanded away by cleansing sleep. Sharp fear and determination run through all my movements and thoughts as I march into the cafeteria. My stomach is roaring alive from a day of no food, and I don't pay much attention as I get in line to collect my fish and mystery sop. It's not until I have my tray in hand and am headed towards our usual table that I realize something is different. There are other people sitting where my team usually sits, people that are not on my team. But not to worry, I think. It's not like we're an exclusive club or anything, and so I sit down at the only remaining seat, instantly scarfing down as much of my breakfast as possible. Once seated, however, I notice that something is wrong. The faces of the people sitting at the table are completely foreign to me. Trying not to stare, I look around at them and realize they are not anyone from my class. But they are also not of anyone in any of the other classes either. They do not belong here, at the Constitute, I realize. They're wearing the right gear, all of them dressed in our signature green jumpsuits, but it's not just that I've never seen them before. They don't quite carry themselves like we do. They don't look quite as tired and without the added forced tautness we try to exude to hide that exhaustion. I find myself relaxing a little around the shoulders, mimicking their lax postures, and stop myself from rubbing my tired eyes. Then I notice that I am not the only one to be quietly stealing glances at the others around the table. Everyone sitting in our little circle is trying to figure each other out, narrowing their eyes in concentration as if trying to place faces to something. I'm trying to catch my bearings. Melton's words coming back to me now as my grogginess begins to lift.
Tomorrow's a big day. You didn't hear it from me.
When someone starts screaming on the other side of the dining hall,
Hyacinth!
A man about my age is screaming while he points at Trellin. Even though the man's behavior is deeply unsettling, my first thought when I see Trellin is one of relief. I'm not alone. The others from my class are here somewhere. Everyone is staring now. Some of us half stand as if we aren't sure if we want to stay uninvolved or rush to Trellin's defense. While we're all watching, I notice Aileen somewhere to my left, Clancy near where Trellin is standing, wide-eyed and terrified, and to my immediate right, at the table next to mine, I can see that Poppin is slowly shaking his head like he can't believe what is happening.
Hyacinth!
The man screams again, and two guards, real guards from the looks of it, not teachers playing dress-up, come through the front of the cafeteria, grab Trellin by the arm, and drag her out of the room as she begins to sob.
I don't understand,
she wails.
I don't understand.
That makes two of us, I think to myself. Just as soon as she is pulled out of the front door, the man who was screaming at Trellin smiles to himself, sits back down, and continues to eat his breakfast like nothing has happened. I try not to let it show that I'm feeling deeply disturbed as I try to pull apart what just happened. For one, I know that there are new people here, new people I don't know, and that may not be friendly. Then there is the fact that everyone is going along with it for whatever reason. On top of that, one of the few people I've recognized so far has been screamed at and taken away by mean-looking, heavily armed guards. This does not bode well for my own situation. And, most importantly, I'm starting to get the distinct feeling that the new people don't know much more than I do, at least not about who's who, going by their scrupulous looks. Everyone at my table is still eyeing each other wearily when it happens again.
Hyacinth!
A shrill voice calls out, and we all turn collectively to watch as a woman, much like the man just moments earlier, is pointing and grinning at another woman. The other woman looks horrified, eyes wide, angry.
I'm not one of them, you idiot!
She hisses, just loudly enough so that we can all hear, and when she says this, the woman pointing at her groans loudly.
But I was sure! I saw you talking to one! The one they just took! I saw you!
She hollers, hysterical now.
She asked me to hand her the sweet salt, you fucking idiot!
The accused woman spits out at her accuser. The door bangs open, and the guards are upon both of them this time, dragging them out. The women screaming at each other, more interested in disparaging the other one's character than they are seemingly worried by being dragged about by armed sentries. Another piece of the mystery falls into place. Trellin was called Hyacinth and removed, making her accuser happy. Trellin is someone from the Constitute and someone I know. The second woman I had never seen before, and when she accused the third woman, also someone I didn't know, as being Hyacinth, both her and her accuser were removed. For some reason, I don't feel as discombobulated as before. There are rules here, and if there are rules, I can win. I finish my breakfast, making sure to make just as much covert eye contact as the other people at the table. We all sit for a long time after we've emptied our plates, everyone waiting for someone to make the first move, as if this move alone would give away that you were Hyacinth worthy. After another excruciating 20 minutes, one of them finally stands and brings their tray over to the washing station, and as soon as she does, we all follow suit. Then we all start wandering towards the classrooms, like a big herd, unsure who is actually leading us or why. This morning, our first class is Ancient Animal Species, with Professor Zanis, and the room is crowded, as there are almost three times as many people in the room as usual, not counting Croy, who is still in the medical building, and Trellin, who has already fallen victim to the strange invaders. Xanis is business as usual, telling us to open our textbooks to page 212, though no one goes to open their bags, as if frozen. The professor seems undeterred by this and starts powering up the projector, beginning her lecture as usual. After about 10 minutes on ancient farming practices, she pulls up a photo and turns to the class. Can anyone tell me what ancient, extinct species this animal is? You should have read about it last night.
It's a cow.
Pompey's voice is monotonous, his answer spat out as an automatic response. He didn't even raise his hand, I realize. We all turn to face where he is leaned up against the wall, and a cacophony of "Hyacinth!" is flung at him. Pompey cringes. The guards appear as before and take him outside into the hallway, though none of us are as afraid as Trellin was this morning, as this is clearly some sort of test. At least, hopefully it is. After classes are over, we head to dinner. This time, I sit at a different table, just for good measure. I pass Clancy as I get in line for my tray of mush and fish, but neither of us makes eye contact, and he passes me like a stranger. For almost 6 hours, I had close to forgotten about last night, about Liam, about Clancy almost dying, and it takes a huge effort to remain calm. To not cry out after Clancy, to tell him I'm sorry, even though that doesn't make sense. No one speaks as we chew our sop, but I can tell that some of the others are cringing at the taste of the food, and so I make an effort to look surprised by its foulness as well. I'm one of you. I try to signal with my disgust at looks while I stab tiny holes into my fish as if to soften it up. Then it's time for our nightly trainings. Tonight is a simple free-range tactical. Everyone is handed a splatter gun, but unlike our usual teams, Rustin assigns us at random, and for tonight, I'm on Team Delta. Aileen and Blake end up on the same team as I, but we make sure to pretend we don't know each other. The terrain is pretty straightforward. There's a box in the middle of a giant square field that we have to retrieve and bring back to our team's camp. The usual hiding spots, bushes, trees, huts, are sprinkled throughout for us to take cover. It's strange trying to not coordinate with Aileen like we usually do, and I realize how in tune we really are.
You go right and then flank back to the left after taking fire away from me.
The short man, with curly blonde hair, tells me this like he's my team leader, but despite the urge to furrow my brow at him, I just nod and get into position. I can tell that several people on the team want to yell Hyacinth at him, as he calls out orders like he's done this before. Pretend like you have never held a splatter gun, I tell myself. One woman's mouth seems to almost be twitching as she concentrates on the man telling us what to do, and just as the whistle is about to sound, signaling that it's time to start, she points at him and screams, "Hyacinth!" Guards appear and take them both away, bringing our team down to 10 people out of 12.
"Great, now we'll never win!"
Blake sounds genuinely pissed, and before he can get another word in edgewise, three of the other team members point and declare him Hyacinth. Someone who doesn't go to the Constitute would not genuinely care about winning the mission, I realize. I make a note to put in as little effort as possible. The whistle sounds, and I make a lame attempt at following the directions of a blonde guy, getting popped with 3 splatter balls before I even make it past the first layer of brush and into the open field. Slowly, I walk back to my new team's starting point and wait it out. This is beginning to get tedious. I want my team back. I want to deal with what happened. And most of all, I want to talk to Clancy to make sure that he's okay. I curse myself for not talking to him the morning after it happened, when I still had the chance. When the training ends and we all reconvene inside, I notice that Poppin and Layla are both missing, and that the overall number of newcomers has dwindled by half. Only Clancy, Stella, Aileen, myself, and, to my chagrin, Liam, have remained amidst the fold of the strangers. I wonder what it will earn us. When it's over and we're told to go home, I slowly trot back to my dorm room, get ready for bed, and fall into a deep sleep, with the hope that this strange experiment will have ended by morning. Whatever the reason for putting us through this better be good, I think as I drift off. It's still dark out when someone bangs on my door, and I have to shield my eyes from the bright light in the hallway when I open up. It's Rustin, in full tactical gear. "You're up, Harper. You're getting pulled into the field. Special mission. Pack a bag and let's go." And just like that, I'm done with my Constitute training.